Our panel session this morning, will new events concepts like the Commonwealth Esports Games, festivals in the metaverse and hybrid conferences continue to emerge, or are we seeing a post-COVID return to traditionalism? Where are the synergies between rights holders and events hosts, and how can they support each other's development? Delighted my panel this morning, representing rights holders, the virtual host, the eSport, the metaverse, and a traditional physical city and global event host, Beng Chu Lau, Secretary General from the World Baseball Softball Confederation. Andy Mia, Professor Andy Mia from eSports Federation and Commission Council Member of the Metaverse, and Tina Eriksson Green from the City of Copenhagen, who delivered such a wonderful grand départ for the Tour de France this year. So I guess I want to start this morning just by, it's impossible to really talk about the future without reflecting a little bit on the last couple of years. So I guess I'd just like to start with each of you, just quickly introduce your organisation, and then just talk a little bit about how the last couple of years has forced you to look at how and why you operate in relation to major events. What's changed? Beng.
Thank you, Robbie. Well, one of the things that we found ourselves in position as almost everyone, it wasn't just the COVID, but we've had to deal with environmental changes, I mean, like typhoons, hurricanes that have caused tremendous devastation. So we had to relook at our events. Obviously, physical events had to be cancelled for about two over years. And then we found ourselves in a position where we had to fast forward. For example, we were already doing esports. We were invited to do the Olympic Virtual Series. But we ourselves, we had a three-point strategy to do mobile apps, to do console for pros, and then, of course, to do a hybrid for virtual reality. And because of the COVID situation and cancellation of physical events, we found ourselves fast-forwarding. Therefore, we had to quickly find ourselves, because we didn't have the technology, we didn't have enough know-how within our organization, obviously, because we have a secretariat, but the rest of us are all volunteers. So we had to look for people in the industry, experts that were doing mobile apps, that were doing the console pro games, and we were able to launch our virtual baseball World Cup. And then we just finished our Baseball 5 physical event. But we had to find a way, because now we have a whole load of new audience and fans online. We obviously, because we are doing a physical Baseball 5, we cannot neglect, because we have now engaged these people who are in the virtual world. We therefore had a special award, what we call the social MVP, for someone who could do the videos, who were online, so that they were also part of it. And we found ourselves not only doing the events, but also changing the way that we engage. I mean, obviously, as Matthew said, you cannot replace physical events, not in sports, because the highs and the lows, the feel-good factor of sports, you need to have a physical event. There's only so much you can do online. Even esports, they need to be physically present somewhere to do esports. So it's not as if like everybody's, you know, somewhere behind a screen. But because of that, we found ourselves having to marry the physical. I mean, you go to a stadium of 20,000, 30,000, the feel-good factor, the engaging, like, you know, it wasn't just the beer and the hot dogs, you know, it was the cheering, you know, the crying or whatever, the highs and the lows and the feel-good factor. But then what about the online people? Hey, don't leave us out. What do we do to engage? You know, we want to be part of that. So when we did our esports, we had actual baseball legends being the commentators for our esports event. And then now, because we have the physical event, how do we get the people online? So we had the people who were physically present doing, you know, videos, doing posts, so that there's the total engagement. So in other words, it was a total fast forward to make sure that we were more inclusive than what we wanted to. Instead of doing it in 5 years, 10 years, no luxury, do it now, and do it quick.
So the last couple of years have accelerated change for you.
Totally, adapting and changing is like a new norm.
So Andy, explain the metaverse in as Paul said, in an elevator pitch in 1 minute.
Well, Robbie, you're in good company, because even my brother and sister still don't know what I do exactly, but As you say, I work at university and I'm very proud to be part of the Global Esports Federation Metaverse Council. And hearing the talks already this morning, I thought to myself, we had mega events in our household during COVID every day, Monday to Friday. And for those that aren't in the UK, it was for us, my son was 9 years old at the time, and it was PE with Joe Wicks, 9 till 9:30 every day. And I'm delighted to be joining Joe this week for a BBC Children in Need fundraiser on Friday. And my son is idolising him. And as a result of that, has combined a lot of his screen-based time with his physical activity. And actually, you'd be very lucky to have an event as successful as a PE with Joe Wicks event. So we do sort of reflect on the physical, the interface between the physical and digital, but actually so much has been achieved by making those sorts of online events really meaningful for people. And the challenge for us going forward is to combine those things. Another big event happened for me this week. For the first time, my son is now 12, and he spent his first amount of money on a computer game. So, you know, subscription-based model, a free game, but you can pay for additional stuff in the game to get further in it so you don't spend your whole life playing the game to get one thing. So he's now started his, hopefully not too expensive, journey in paying for that gaming content. Here's a new audience experience being nurtured over the childhood that we're partly concerned about, but is a new set of expectations around the event. So COVID, for me, was a crystallization of a new event economy based upon the habits that are being formed by that next generation. And accessing that is crucial. As you mentioned, integrating the physical is critical, and physical events are central to esports. And the metaverse is principally, I think, exciting because it's about the integration of those two worlds. The phygital experience is how I talk about it. How do you get these people together to compete, to enjoy the benefits of the technological innovation that the events require, but also what we've seen over this time is an acceleration of the entire entourage of those events. So architects that are looking to esports as the next stadium of the future, not because of the event itself, but because the principles of design that go into the event are informing so many other things. Ivo mentioned the use of augmented reality to bring that second screen experience into this angle rather than that angle, so you can see what's in front of you. And that's a great example of how you can adjust to those expectations. So for me, COVID, and I don't think we are post-COVID, by the way, in fact, you can look at the last 10 years and see how many viruses affected mega events. And we ought to be in the frame of mind where we think about that as an expectation going forward. All the best science tells us that we will have other such events, and we need to maintain those principles of working through it. But crucial to that is understanding the transformation of expectations of the events. The digital first fan is, I think, the fan of the future.
And Tina, over to you. In terms of the last couple of years, how's that impacted on the work of Copenhagen in attracting major events, but also, as I mentioned before, delivering probably one of the biggest global events, the Grand Départ of the Tour de France earlier this year?
Yes, well, thank you. I'm from the Copenhagen city, so it's a bit of a different perspective, I think, from the side of course being both serving the people and but having a council with the political decisions. And I think for us, really, we were both to host Euro 2020, the World Pride and Euro Games, and the Tour de France. And at one point, it looked as if they might all be the same year, really, because of being pushed forward. But we ended having the Euro 2020 and 21, as well as the World Pride. And really, that meant that we had to rethink a lot of concepts for still being able to involve the fans, but also the local citizens, in a way that was both safe, of course, during the pandemic, but still sort of brought people together, both in ways of using much more large screen viewings of matches and events, having much more localization of different smaller events that then was brought together, either by sort of sharing a screen or by being able to meet up for the sort of the finals, and then with the Tour de France, at that point we were beyond having restrictions. So what it really was for us was just a massive conclusion that what major events can do is really create a community, a spontaneous community that you don't need to have invested in for a long time. It's not a club that you've joined since you were a kid and you've nurtured, but it's really a sense of community that just exists in that moment and we needed that more than ever, I think, after some really hard years. So I think from a more sort of political perspective, the focus was really on what value do we need to get out of major events? How do we make sure that our whole community is behind them? And how do we form new partnerships so there's much more local stakeholders are involved in the event?
Great, thank you very much. I think we've got the opportunity for a couple of polls, if that's right. No. Yes. Okay, Ben's. While we're talking, Ben's going to put some stuff up. You've got this is the only time you're allowed to get your phones out. The rest of the time, put them away, please. Cameron.
Before you start, this question is for a certain segment of the audience. Is that right, Robbie?
No, I'd like everybody to put themselves in the shoes or the boots or the pockets of a rights holder. So put yourself in the possession of a rights holder. In order of importance, the stakeholders in hosting a major event. So I'm trying to get a sense of, I guess, post-pandemic, what does this mean for a rights holder? Who are the most important stakeholders for you? Is it your sponsors, your athletes, performers, your visitors, your fans, your local citizens and communities? I guess local citizens and communities are in the host. We'll let that sort of populate and see where we get to. But in the meantime, we'll come back to this in a second. Picking up on I guess how the audience has changed, Ben. You talked about how your audience has changed. You've got your physical event audience, and you've got your virtual audience. What are the a word that Tina used was values? What are the values now that are shaping that audience, and how you communicate with that audience?
Well, I don't think the core values of sports have changed. I mean, there's always sportsmanship. There's always integrity. But what has changed is the way we do things, as Ivo mentioned and as Paul mentioned. There's so many new challenges that you need to look at. As I mentioned just now, it wasn't just COVID. I mean, we found ourselves when we were doing events the last 3 months, suddenly there were hurricanes, there were typhoons, devastation. How do you convince the local community that you're going to have to spend money on your sport event so that there's a feel-good factor, but people don't have homes, people don't have food, people don't have electricity? So it was a question of how do you engage to convince the local community that it wasn't just bringing an event to feel good about it. There are other factors that you need to, you know, as David even mentioned, for the local community, as Susan mentioned, what would your event do for the people? So we have found ourselves looking more at questions of how do you engage the community in terms of unity, how do you engage the community in terms of legacy, and also for us as a rights holder of the event, we found ourselves that we had to put in a lot more investment in places and in areas that we didn't have to do so much of. And this was different from sponsors where you use the people's money. This was money that we had to look for. And instead of putting it in something else, we suddenly found ourselves having to put, and this is what we call the private monies. I mean, no doubt we were in Tokyo, but we had to find money to get into Tokyo and continue after that. So where do we find money? We had to create events. And one of the things that, you know, as Andy mentioned, you know, even our esports programs, that was a new source of revenue as well. We had to look at it. It wasn't just putting money. But of course, we're not going to get the returns like immediately. I mean, like your son, it was 3 years before he started doing content, you know, buying. So we need to make sure that everything we do now, we are even more conscious of how do we engage the local communities, as Tina has mentioned, to convince them that it's money put to use, not just because it's a feel-good factor, but we are putting our money in as well. So we are more convinced than the local community because we're prepared to put where the money is to do the event. Yeah. But what do we do for you? We found ourselves having to do a lot more. For example, like in LA 28 now, we have already started engaging in the legacy programs even for the last 2 years, 3 years. And LA is 28, so you just imagine the amount of time, the amount of money that you need to put in. But we also need to engage more people, the people with the know-how, with the technology, because it wasn't that we will not be able to do this. Like our World Series, you know, the virtual, our social MVP, we would not be able. We, no doubt, we had to put in the investment because we had found ourselves, we suddenly had to do a whole IT team. We had to suddenly do a whole esports team, you know, by the way, that's where a lot of the people are going from one IF to another IF, especially in the esports, you know, and the IT sector. But for us, it needs to be sustainable. Whatever we do, we need to be very conscious that this is not something that we are doing just because, you know, and as you all said, COVID is not to go away. With globalization, God forbid, you know, the pandemics are here to stay. Then, you know, the environment is getting, climate change is a real thing. You're going to get worse hurricanes, worse typhoons. What are you going to do about that? Yeah. But meanwhile, we need to invest in this. And are we sure that we are going to invest it in the right places, that they are sustainable 5 years, 10 years down the road? Or is this just a feel good and that's it, tomorrow we're not going to do our virtual world, baseball World Cup anymore? No, we can't.
Andy?
Yeah, I mean...
I was going to say, how's your audience, how's the esports and audience changing? Because you talked about a 13-year-old boy. Yeah. As a father of teenage boys, how is esports broadening out beyond an audience of teenage boys to, dare I say it, the demography in this room?
Well, I think what's really exciting is it is broadening in very quickly, actually. But as people were speaking, I was thinking about my own beginnings, actually. I began working with the British Olympic Association in 1999, attending the National Olympic Academy, and subsequently went to the IOA, which I'm very delighted to hear mentioned by Sam earlier, and have since been to every Olympic Games. And at the same time, I happened to be around Much Wenlock in August, walking around the village, thinking about the origins of this movement. And hearing you speak, what we're trying to achieve principally, I think, is establishing strong communities of participation, which, of course, need to be far in excess of the duration of the event as it lands in a particular location. And the challenge is how to ensure that, how to ensure that people feel like Olympic citizens, even when the games aren't in their city. And I think that is the broad aspiration that underpinned the formation of not just the Olympic movement, modern Olympic movement, but also modern sport more widely. And I think that's what still excites us. The problem is it's really hard to do that work, to do it well and to engage people meaningfully over a period of time. I think what we're trying to do with the metaverse, but also with esports more generally, is realize that both the habits of young people are dramatically different. I mean, if I asked the audience today how many of you have been on TikTok, I'm guessing the hands won't be terribly numerous, but this is the world in which those young people are living. If you've never tried gesture control in virtual reality, then there's a whole future of experiences that you haven't got the insight into yet. And I think that's crucial, because actually understanding the transformation of those expectations, of which esports is a manifestation, those new habits, those new expectations of events, and the new ways in which community is formed, is at the heart of this metaverse proposition. So in terms of a takeaway for the metaverse, if it's a world that you still feel you don't quite get, you're in good company, because most people still don't either. And what's exciting about it is that people are being able to create this world, imagine it. And it's the Imagineers that are driving it forward, I would say, at the moment. The possibility that in the future, that if your local Olympic pool, 50-meter pool, can have a digital overlay on the water as the Olympic Games is happening, and you can see the athletes digitally represented on that pool as you're sitting in the gallery, when the event's happening thousands of miles away, that's the sort of experience that people are imagining. And that's incredibly exciting. So that's a whole different way of thinking about what community could be in these sort of second live site experiences.
I hope you're not saying that because none of us are engaged with TikTok, then the future of major events is in the wrong hands.
Not so much.
We should hand it over to the younger generation.
Not at all. It's really just to bookmark the idea that those transformations in what audiences expect are born out of the platforms that in fact a lot of our community aren't really using, which is why it's useful to hear from and observe what the young people are doing in order to see those habits form. And that's crucial to understand what's going on here.
Tina, you alluded before to perhaps a change or a change in balance as a traditional city, host city, from encouraging visitors and tourism fans from outside to redressing the balance towards the local community and the needs of the local community. How's Copenhagen doing that?
Well, I think that, I mean, also looking up here, I think a lot of us agree that communities have to be brought in. I also think that it's not a either-or. You can still, I mean, I think a fan experience, a visitor experience is much greater when you feel that it's actually a local experience, that the authenticity is there. So I think that it just means that you you do an extra work to also engage the local communities, and thereby I think the experience for the visitor or for the fan will also be increased. With the Grand Depart, we had we're not out with all the official numbers yet, but we had the same amount of people standing along our 13-kilometer time trial in the inner city in Copenhagen. That was the same amount of people that lives in Copenhagen. So I mean the it was an absolute. Like everywhere, I completely agree that you can also bring people together in the metaverse, but to see actually people brought together in the hundreds of thousands along that route and the community that just happened there between visitor fans and the local citizens, I think was tremendous. And afterwards, we of course done a poll to ask people what their experiences was, but also what their expectations were. And what I think was striking there was that one thing was that the fans, the ones that identifies themselves as cycling fans, they had an amazing experience and was high up on the satisfaction list. But really, the people who before said, we don't know if we're fans, we can't say no, we can't say yes, we're not particularly interested. They had just a high satisfaction rate. So I think what happened there was much more than just the sport. It was actually being part of a global community right there. So I think that it's really a win-win for everybody, that the volunteers are local volunteers, because then they also become the representatives of the city and they give the visitors and the fans a great experience. And I also think that the fans themselves might see different angles to the sport they love when you have these crossover cultural activities as well, because you bring in a lot of different aspects to something that they have maybe traveled to see in lots of different cities before. Yeah. So I think it's definitely something that benefits all partners.
Great. Well, as you said, perhaps surprisingly, I don't know, local citizens and communities ranking higher than sponsors. Hopefully there's not too many sponsors disappointed about that. Ben, can we go for the second poll, which is just the same question, but from the perspective of a host destination or city? So again, put yourself in the boots or shoes of Glasgow or Copenhagen, for example, and talk and just answer. You know, rank in order the importance of those and see where we get to. What I'd like to do just, and before finishing, we've got about another 5 minutes or so and then a couple of questions. We've talked a little bit about the rights holders. We've talked a little bit about the new audiences and changes in audience. How do we balance the changing needs and requirements of a rights holder with the audience, whether that's a physical audience or a virtual audience? Bang.
Yeah, just following up on the example that Tina mentioned, we just finished our Baseball 5 World Cup. By the way, Baseball 5 was started so that we could do an easy sport that local communities could do and smaller federations could do. All you need is just a 21-meter square and you bat with your hand. But apart from two actual competition fields of play, we also ensured that we had fan engagement. So we actually had two courts that were set up, where the local people could come and say, look, this is a sport that I can do or I can try. And also online, we also had that. So people then start to engage in your sport. It's not as if like it's something that you bring and 1 week later you're gone and that's it. You know, but it's something which, because they have engaged in, you sold them on the idea that there's something which they can do and it's something which is real. The idea of accepting you is even very much more. So it's not just a matter of finding the sponsor, put your money, find the sponsors, do an event, goodbye, thank you very much for your hospitality. Maybe we'll see you again, you know, maybe, you know, 5 years, 10 years later. Now it's every event that we do, how do you engage not only the fans but the local community and convince your local sponsors that it was worth the while?
Okay. I'm going to open up for questions if we've got any hands around the room.
Hi everyone, James Truman from Deloitte Consulting and Future Sport Lead. A question for Andy. I was actually in Glasgow last week with a number of our Scottish sports clients, and one of the attendees observed that actually 90% of sports fans or people who have an interest in sport actually never attend sports events live. So I think there's massive potential for things like the metaverse. However, I think Meta recently launched their latest product, which I believe is $1,500. And this seems a tremendously high price point that's inaccessible for most people. Do you think the metaverse will become mainstream? If so, when do you think that will be?
When you started off, I thought, wow, 90%, that's a low estimate. And because actually I think that 99% of people don't attend live events at all. And actually the economy around it just does need to think about that major contribution that they're making. I think it's really interesting because I was one of the Google Glass explorers that took it around the world and showed people and it never came into reality. And there's something fascinating about this. It's a great quote from William Gibson, the science fiction writer. The future's already here, it's just unevenly distributed. And I think in some respects, when we go to elite events, when we take part at them, even remotely, and I remember watching the Australian Grand Prix in 2020 when it switched into an online event broadcast on YouTube, and I watched it, and I couldn't tell the difference. The graphics were so good. The modelling of the city was perfect. That it felt like, and the commentary, of course, the staging of it, the orchestration was just like a Grand Prix, that it felt like the same. And it was a major shift for me in thinking about that relationship between the live physical event and that digital participatory event, which can happen synchronous now. So I think that the metaverse prospect is always going to be a combination of the sorts of things that are off-the-shelf affordable, like the Oculus Quest 2 headset, which is £300, and the emerging MetaQuest of 1,500. But what's interesting is, and I was saying this to Johnny, who's in the audience earlier, that my son has already, over the last few years, taken part in a number of birthday parties at VR venues. And we've seen around cities things like esports, gaming cafes. So there's a whole new audience experience that's been created through the technology, which doesn't rely on people having it themselves, but it involves them going to, actually, I would say, and this is a really important part of the long tail of all of this, is if you imagine the gym of the future, it is a gym that's integrated with the principles of esports and metaverse technologies. Why would you go to a gym if you can do a Joe Wicks workout online in your living room? You go there because the technological offer is so exciting. You can watch the Tour de France, but not just watch it, you can participate on the bike at the same time. And that participatory element is crucial to, I think, this entire economy. Getting that right and giving people an insight into that future of what's possible is a big part of the excitement.
Andy, thanks very much. Cameron?
Thanks, Robbie. Cameron Fraser, Scottish Rugby Union, also owner and operator of the fifth largest stadium and venue in the UK, BT Murrayfield. So it's a really interesting point to continue on from what Andy was saying around that participatory element. So my question, which I'll get to in just a second, is around the definition of esports. So Robbie and I have shared not a physical piece of physical activity together, but virtual. So it's around, so when I'm served esports, you then see pictures of people playing computer games. So what does the panel consider is important going forward in communicating what esports is? Is it kids playing computer games, or is it rather kids doing Joe Wicks classes in the living room, adults taking part in cycling participation in their garages or living rooms, or indeed going out and about in green spaces on an app doing physical activity? Because I think from what I'm seeing, and despite my grey hairs, I'm actually an avid kind of user of that kind of participatory online world space. How do we ensure that the lines aren't blurred between what you were describing there, Andy, which is absolutely spot on, versus say lots of screen time and kids being in the rooms playing computer games and being classed as a fan of potentially esports? Is there a blurred line, or is there a clear space between esports and gaming, computer gaming?
I'm going to possibly hand this to Andy again, but I think it's probably all of the above. I mean, I think all the things that Cameron's mentioned there's opportunities there. And back to your point around participation, all of those, I guess, serve up opportunities for everybody.
I mean, certainly one of the things I was really proud about with Global Esports, in Birmingham this year, we held the first Commonwealth Esports Championships, within which there was a demonstration of World Taekwondo's future active esports, where you are wearing, you've got wearable technologies and you're virtually sparring with somebody else. And I think that, again, when Thomas Bach sort of urged sports federations to get their act together with esports, the starting point, of course, people look to the industry and where it is, and there's the money and there's the participation. But my approach as a professor, as someone that's interested in the future, is actually we are in the business of defining esports, and a part of that is the expansion of it into digital experiences, real world arena experiences that are transforming the staging of the sports we already know into something very different. So new disciplines, new types of activities, where the entire theatrical staging of space is a remarkably different proposition. And that is perfectly compatible with my definition of esports. In fact, I think if you just look to the consoles and keyboards at the moment, you miss a big part of the potential of this world. And actually, a lot of the stuff that we do on those devices and platforms is best done in a more physically active way. So the interface is evolving. My son's still learning in school with a keyboard and a mouse. He's not going to be using that in 20 years' time. So you have to sort of think, approach it from that perspective, and I think it's a perspective that will help us usher in something even more exciting.
Okay, I'm going to hand the last word over to Tina, because Ben has showed me the pre-prepared one-minute slide.
not a very metaverse example, but still on the E side of things. Actually, one of the, I think, really heartwarming programs that was formed by the community around the Tour de France was seniors doing an e-bike scheming plan to be able to bike the time trial themselves, so the 13 kilometers. So for the 6 months leading up to the Tour de France, we were engaging these different community homes for elderly people, where they then had all these competitions on their e-bikes and how far they could go. They also, of course, biked some of the previous Tour de France stages in their on their own speed and on their e-bikes, and then they all gathered the ones that could on the day after the Grand Départ to do the 13 kilometers themselves. But really the whole process and how they had gotten together 6 months prior to train, I think was only possible because you had the side of course also doing it on an e-bike and being transferred to France from your senior care home.
Great, thank you very much.
It's like a perfect world, isn't it? There is a real sport. Mm-hmm. I wish I could do the sport. You can now in the digital world.
Exactly, and I think to sum up, as Beng mentioned at the beginning, you've got with baseball, softball, having to move to virtual, but also now at the point where you're back to physical, but retaining that important audience. As Andy and the gentleman from Deloitte said, that whether it's 90 or 99% of fans that are not engaging, that's a huge number of people that we've yet got to engage with, and an opportunity for us all. But I think as Tina was saying, and as Susan mentioned in the first panel, and underlined by the responses in the polls we've had, the importance of the sense of community in terms of our as our audience going forward in hosting major events. And thank you to the panel, Tina, Andy, and Ben. And that's us. And time for coffee, I think, Ben.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.